Log now broadcasting in English.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio with me, Jan Wellinger. In today's weekend program, we have a new edition of Mailbox for you that, of course, hosted by Pavla Horáková, will be answering your questions and responding to your comments. Topics covered in today's edition include Radio Prague's upcoming 75th birthday and also controversial comments made by some Czech officials regarding a recent gay pride festival in the Czech capital. That did get a lot of response, so be sure to stay tuned for that. After Mailbox, we delve deep into DNA in Czech science, and we'll round out the program with another episode of our popular history series from the archives. First, though, let's get started with Mailbox and our very own Pavla Horáková.
Hello and welcome to Mailbox. First of all, I would like to thank all of you who have wished Radio Prague a happy 75th anniversary. Preparations for our celebration on August the 31st are well underway. A special news conference on the current state of international broadcasting will be held here in the Czech Radio building, where an exhibit of the 75 years of Radio Prague will be on display. On August the 31st, a Czech radio tent will be set up in the Prague city centre, where staff will distribute Radio Prague promotional materials, and there will also be live broadcasts from the tent. Those of you who tune in to the Radio Prague broadcast on August the 31st will receive a special stamped QSL card. We will be looking forward to your reception reports. Now on to your emails. Last weekend's Prague Pride Gay and Lesbian March sparked controversy among Czech officials, and some of our listeners reacted to their statements. Karen Rose, who has dual Czech and US citizenship, commented on the fact that Prague's mayor, Bohuslav Svoboda, had refused a call from Prague Archbishop Dominik Duka to withdraw his support for the festival.
Doesn't the dear Archbishop realize that there exists a separation of church and state, and that calling on officials to influence them one way or the other is just not done in a democracy?
Frank Miata from New York City is a former Prague resident.
I was shocked to read about Petr Hayek's comments concerning the gay and lesbian festival in Prague. We have an expression in America, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. The views of Mr. Hayek's boss on climate change most certainly could be called deviant, odd, or strange. Hayek seems to have missed the reason for the city's tolerant welcome of this festival, commerce. If there is a deviant mind at work, Petra should look in the mirror.
Carl G. Smith from Iceland responded to an older Radio Prague story.
Thanks for your Josef Lada article. I've always loved his beautiful paintings, Bohemian Peasants, Christmas, and so on. I am sorry Lada is not well known here. I wish our television would represent him and his work.
Colin Law from New Zealand experienced a technical problem with our email news service.
I am writing to tell you, in case you don't already know about it, there seems to be a problem with your mail system. At the time of writing, I have not yet received your news email that would normally have arrived here about 9 hours ago. Examination of the headers in delivery of news on 8th of August and of Radio Prague today on the 9th of August suggests that the emails are getting stuck in your file servers.
Thank you very much for alerting us to the problem, and we apologize for the inconvenience. Matt and Amy Smith, on the other hand, asked to be removed from Radio Prague's e-news mailing list.
It's a pity that the right of free speech isn't based on the obligation to say something sensible.
Do you share their view, or do you have a different opinion of Radio Prague's broadcasts? Please let us know. We rely on your feedback to make our programs better. In a similar tone, Bill Bergadano dropped us this note.
So how is the internet radio thing going? I was just wondering, since you made the very myopic choice to go to web and satellite-delivered content, have you gotten 100 listeners yet?
First, let me repeat that it was not Radio Prague's idea to discontinue shortwave broadcasts, but rather a result of the current economic reality. Judging from the ceaseless flow of emails, as well as the ever-growing crowd of Radio Prague fans on Facebook, our audience definitely exceeds 100. And here's a comment on the subject by Siegfried Rambaum, who left it on our Facebook page.
I actually listen more to Radio Prague on the internet than on the radio. Last but not least, because I can browse the section archives and listen to what piques my curiosity.
Do you follow Radio Prague? Do you enjoy our broadcasts? Is there something you miss in our programs? Please let us know. We appreciate your feedback. And if you include a correct answer to our monthly quiz in your email, you may even win a Radio Prague goodie bag. In August, we are looking for the name of a Mexican film actress who was born in 1926 in Prague and died in Mexico City only 29 years later. Please send us her name by the end of August to english@radio.cz. Any questions and comments are welcome. Make sure to tune in on August the 31st for the special 75th anniversary broadcast. Your reception reports will be rewarded by special QSL cards. Mailbox will be back again on September the 3rd. Until then, take care.
Pavla Horáková with that edition of Mailbox. We turn now to another edition of Czech Science, hosted by Christian Falvey.
We've heard the politicians and the eco-activists' views on the Šumava, but what do the scientists say? And by the way, how do cells read DNA anyway? That's what we'll be trying to get our heads around this month on Science Journal. Where do the trillions of cells in the human body, or other bodies for that matter, get their instructions from? They read the book of DNA. But how? No one has yet been able to quite figure that out. Scientists from the Molecular Genetics Institute of the Czech Academy of Sciences have taken a good step in the right direction, though, helping to explain how histones, special proteins that help protect DNA in the cell nucleus, can change certain molecules of RNA if they are modified only slightly. Meanwhile, it's incorrect changes to RNA splices that cause a number of diseases, so learning to properly modify the histones could be a step towards curing certain tumorous or neurodegenerative diseases. But why try to explain it poorly myself when I can get expert explanations from Dr. David Staniak of the Molecular Genetics Institute, whose team made the discovery?
All information is stored in DNA about the cells and their shape and communication stored in DNA. What we try to study is how cells read that information, because that information is rather hidden in DNA. And it's actually tricky for cell to read it and get a meaningful information, let's say, out of it. So that's what we studied, the process, how cells read the information stored in DNA. We just push it a bit further. So the trick is that, how to explain that? So information in DNA is basically stored to make proteins, okay? The proteins are actually the working units of cells. They are enzymes, you know. They can make a beer. I mean, they can color your hair. They do many things, proteins.
Okay, I'm with you so far, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, and how to make proteins? The proteins have a specific sequence. Each protein has a specific sequence. And that sequence is stored in DNA, okay? The problem is, and we don't know actually why, and especially in human DNA, to make one protein, the information is stored in different places. It's like, I don't know, like a pearls in a necklace. You can put them together, okay? Like little pearls, put them together. Or, I don't know, you're in the radio, so if you cut a tape, okay, mm-hmm. you put the, you know, scenes you want to together and glue it together, and that's exactly how the cells do it. They take, you know, they translate the information from DNA and just glue together a little pieces. Is that clear?
Yes, that's clear. And so they put together the relevant information from various sources, just like
a
radio reporter.
Exactly. And then different cells can actually put the different, you know, these little pieces together. So from one, you know, DNA sequence, they can make actually different proteins. I mean, it's like a movie. You can glue, like, let's say, happy end or a tragedy, and just, you know, changing the end, you totally change the meaning of the movie. And that's how cells work, actually. You know, they can take, just change a piece of a protein and actually change totally the function of that protein.
And so your insight into this process...
Yeah, so and what was not clear how cells are actually putting these little pieces together, why one cells put a piece A, B, C, while the other cells put together A, B, and D. So, and what we did actually, we found a piece of information that cells are using to put the correct pieces together, okay?
And these are the histones.
Well, that comes to histones. So DNA, you know, just all this putting pieces together is done at the RNA. So there's DNA, information is stored. From DNA, it's transcribed into RNA. Then there's all shuffling and putting pieces together and cutting the others out is done at the RNA level. And then RNA serves as a template for a protein, okay? And till now, everybody believed that all information, you know, all the process of, you know, RNA shuffling, which is actually called RNA splicing or alternative splicing, is done at the RNA level. And what we found is actually that the DNA template and DNA is wrapped around histones. And the histones have a little, like, tags on it that usually tells us, okay, this is gene, this is not the gene, transcribe that, not transcribe that. What we found that also histones and this histone code with little tags can tell cells how to splice RNA. So we actually basically put together two processes that were not connected till now.
And so this discovery also means that it's possible to influence the histones with various substances.
Well, it's been known for a long time, 5 years, that histones and these little tags can be influenced. There are enzymes that can put these tags on or, you know, take them off. And we have a little chemical so that can actually inhibit or enhance those enzymes. So that way we can actually change this histone code. Until now, it was used to change the histone code to change gene expression, meaning, you know, not transcribing or transcribing some genes. And so now we found that also those little chemicals that change the histone code can be used also for changing RNA splicing. And we know that there are several diseases there where the splicing is wrong, and that's what causes disease. So there's a potential, and we haven't tested yet that it's just a potential. I mean, it could be, it may not work, but it could be used to actually correct the missplicing that causes some human, you know, hereditary diseases.
And what kind of diseases does that entail exactly?
Well, the splicing diseases are several of them. There's spinal muscular atrophy, which actually causes death of, you know, child. That, you know, neurons do not develop, so that's a problem. And there's a lot of muscular dystrophies. Other muscular dystrophies are, you know, caused by missplicing. And we know that also now retinitis pigmentosa, which is a hereditary disease, can be partially caused by wrong splicing. So there are several diseases where splicing is wrong. And we may test now, or you know, other labs may test whether those different chemicals that change histone code can also somehow influence RNA splicing and correct RNA splicing.
Is that the first testing that you'll do? Will you jump into trying to correct RNA splicing?
Well, we work on RNA splicing. That's our job. But, I mean, there are many labs that are way ahead of us on how these different diseases work. And they understand in detail how those, you know, splicing can be corrected. So I don't think that's our job. We put that information out and they can use it.
And so how will you go about testing it?
How we will go about it? Well, we would rather go more in basic biology, and we would like to understand how cells and how different cells in our body using this histone code, and how, you know, let's say, you know, we have, you know, neurons, we have muscles, and they all have the same DNA, but they are totally different, they look different, and part of that is done by RNA splicing. So we would like to understand whether the histone code, whether histone code in these different cells can influence different alternative splicing, and understand that way how cells in our body read the information more, you know, go more toward the really basic science, understanding how our body and our cells are working.
What's fuzzy and brown, only 5 millimeters long, and can devour a forest? None other than Ips typographus, better known as the bark beetle, which has done untold damage to one of the most important natural preserves in the Czech Republic, the Šumava, or Bohemian Forest. Part of the UNESCO Biosphere Reserve, and one of the most beautiful places in the country for hiking or skiing, when a tree falls in the Bohemian Forest, whether at the hands of loggers or the mandibles of the bark beetle, everyone hears it. The ongoing debate that we have followed for years now is whether to combat the infestation by logging the infested areas, as the current park management wants to do, or to leave Mother Nature to her own devices to clean up after herself. We hear from the politicians and environmental groups on a regular basis, but less so from the natural scientists. For that sake, I've called Dr. Jan Froes of Charles University's Institute for Environmental Studies, who I asked for a judgment on the polarized positions.
Well, certainly on the both sides, we can see quite strong simplification of the question asked and of the positions. I would rather be in favor of activists because they at least, you know, attract general attention to the problem. The major problem here is that there is a sort of conflict between keeping the nature and providing, let's say, better infrastructure for park and making park more attractive for more demanding tourist industry.
And so ecologically, how can that best be achieved?
This is a very delicate question because basically there is a many studies from Alpine region and other mountain region around the world showing that basically you have a summer and winter visitors. The winter visitors really need a large infrastructure because they don't really see much nature. So what they need is a snow hill and, you know, convenient transportation, very comfort up and down, you know, high quality food. They have to have something after they go skiing. So they have to have, you know, some kind of entertainment and some kind of other services. They are very valuable in terms of money for enterprises. So they try to accommodate them. But the problem is, more you accommodate the winter visitors, more you damage your nature. And you suffer to get summer visitors, because the summer visitors are coming particularly to see nature. So there are two things are going to happen. You are losing the essence why the national park was created. But you are also losing the nature, which is economic attraction for summer tourism. And all the studies made in foreign countries show that regardless, you know, how good conditions you have for skiing, you cannot survive exclusively on winter visitors. So it's a very delicate balance. And simply what we are seeing here now is an attempt from, you know, park management to take a shortcut in this and accommodate, you know, local enterprisers in the short term run, which politically may be highly appreciated, but in long term, it's not a good step.
Well, how would you describe the consensus? In what kind of consensus is there in the scientific community as to how the situation and the infestation should be dealt with?
I mean, there is, I should say, the scientific community is also quite diverse in this, I should say openly. But speaking about environmentalists and people with ecological background, there is quite a consensus that we, in order to keep a national park, we should first try to keep natural processes. The first things to remember is that the nature are not only the species we are going to keep there. I mean, you can go to botanical garden or you can go to zoological garden to see the species, but that would not be the same as having the same species in national park in their natural environment. So the national environment consists from all the national processes that are going to happen. And disasters like wind or bark beetle are inherent part of these natural processes. There is many parts in Šumava Mountains where probably such events happen quite periodically, means, you know, in order each 100, 150 years. So it's maybe not in the same extent, but what we are seeing, it's quite a natural process. And
so then the activists are essentially correct in your view that they should not allow logging at all and leave the forest to its own?
You have to distinguish between area when the natural spruce forest, when the spruce forest is natural, and in the other area when the spruce forest was planted, yeah, when the originally was a beech forest, certainly in area when the spruce forest was planted, when we have artificial plantation now, there is a quite logical to proceed by classical forest management and use logging. But in the places when there was natural spruce forest, there is quite a consensus among ecological community, environmental community, that these sites have to be put to its natural development. This is historical thing, because in Czech there is a long tradition of growing spruce artificially. So general public have really, you know, very bad feeling about leaving a spruce by its own. And it's a cultural thing. But if you go to, let's say, Siberia, there is a quite large area of spruce forest. And there is a quite large area of harvesting of spruce forest and nobody planting that spruce back. The simple law says that if you harvest the forest, you have to leave all trees which have diameter 7 centimeters or less. And if you came to that harvested forest, let's say 2 years after, you see most of the trees in the forest would be up to 1 meter high, or, you know, some would be even taller, like 5, 7, 10 meters. Of course, majority of trees would be very small seedlings. You get quite high speed of recovery, quite fast recovery, and you get a huge diversity of ages and sizes of trees. This is something the foresters would not like particularly, because it makes forest management much more difficult. But it's something which an environmentally oriented scientist would welcome, because you get forest which is more heterogeneous in terms of age, and that forest would get much more resistant, for example, to bark beetles or to some wind or other, you know, natural disasters, and would also support much larger diversity of species because of more diversity of habitats.
Dr. Jan Froes of the Institute for Environmental Studies there, ending this month's edition of Science Journal. We'll be with you again for more science news in roughly 27 days, 23 hours, and 45 minutes. Until then, goodbye.
Czech Science was produced and presented by Christian Falvey, and if you're a fan of Czech Science in general, then why not comment or send us your remarks to english@radio.cz. We're always happy to hear from our listeners. You can also take part in discussion on Facebook, where the discussion is often lively, especially on recent topics, including the gay festival that took place in the Czech capital. Also, just a quick reminder, if you want to look us up on the internet and find any articles that you might have missed in the past, that's also easy to do. You can go to radio.cz and search through our extensive archives, as well as, of course, find out all the latest news from the Czech Republic. Now we turn to our long-running series from the archives with host David Vaughan.
In last week's From the Archives, we heard about radio's central role in the Prague uprising against the German occupation at the end of World War II. Not only did the signal for the uprising to begin come over the air, but the radio also helped to coordinate the fighting. It also played a third role. At the time, the Red Army was already approaching Prague from the east, and General Patton's Third Army was in Plzeň, just a few dozen kilometres to the west. Many of those fighting in the streets of Prague were untrained and had few weapons, and the scale of the German resistance, especially the SS units, took many by surprise. The radio appealed to the Americans, British and Russians for help.
There's Prague! There's Prague! Americans and English, help us! We need guns! There are too many Germans! Send us airplanes and tanks! The Americans before Pilsen! Send us aeroplanes too. The Germans are coming from south, north, west and east. Help us, help us.
Praga! Praga, товарищ!
Prague calls the Red Army. We need your help. Last week, we briefly heard the voice of the escaped Scottish prisoner of war, William Gregg, who was helping to defend the radio. Here he is again, with more than a hint of frustration in his voice, appealing to the Allies for help.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Prague calling London. This is Prague calling London. Once again, we repeat what I have already said 3 or 4 times. The Germans did not keep their promise. Prague is in great danger. The Germans are attacking with tanks and planes. We are calling urgently our allies to help. Send immediately tanks and aircraft. Help us defend Prague. Do not let Prague be destroyed. We need the greatest help possible. We don't know how long we can hold out. We are hoping for the best that English, American or Russian troops will reach us in the next few hours. It has to be very quick and very soon. Good night.
The broadcasts also appealed to German soldiers in the Wehrmacht to hand over their arms. Please stop this unnecessary resistance immediately and give yourselves up to the Czech armed forces. In the end, by the time the Red Army rolled into Prague on the morning of May the 9th, the city had as good as liberated itself, and around 3,000 lives on both sides had been lost in the process. As the tanks came down the hill towards the city centre, they were joined by a jubilant radio reporter. We are coming down the winding road from the castle. On the left is Klarov, on the right Hradčany, and before us a city is spreading out whose joy reaches the stars. At this moment, the Red Army has liberated Prague.
That edition of From the Archives with David Vaughan brings us just about to the end of today's program. We want to thank you so much for listening, and just a quick reminder, be sure to visit us on the web, www.radio.cz/en, for all the latest news from the Czech Republic about politics, culture, and science. I'm Jan Vellinger for all of us here at the station. Thanks so much for joining us this day, and take care. Thank you.
vous écoutez Radio.